You think you can do it?
Corporal Brassard flicked the private a glance of pure contempt. The tow-headed youth was a newbie they'd picked up on the coast from a nest of inbred surf rats. They were bad as hillies in the corporal's estimation. The kid was lucky to have a chin and only 10 fingers. But he hadn't missed out on dumb.
Course he can't, Mickles. Muties will eat his lunch. And we shag ass back to the rail wagon report we done our level best, too bad about the Baron's daughter.
It was a stretch to call the boss of the little ville of Tucumcari Baron. Miguel Mike Sanchez was a nervous fat man with sweeping white side whiskers and watery blue eyes, one of which displayed a distracting tendency to look everywhere except where the other one was. He had a silver fob watch in the pocket of his sun-faded, sweat-stained vest, which didn't work, but did serve as a symbol of authority, such as it was. His handful of sekmen weren't particularly sinister for the breed, lacking much of the usual vicious swagger, but likewise weren't real effectual. His domain, which was just a little straggle of buildings, halfway reclaimed ruins or shanties scratch-built from materials scabbied out of the ruins of the old town, on whose erstwhile eastern outskirts it lay. He ran it with a sort of absent-minded indulgence. Contrary to the current wisdom that held that the more ruthless the baron, the better off the vill, Tucumcari didn't seem to have suffered greatly from his slackness. As small as it was, the vill prospered relatively, off scabby grubbed out of the ruins of the old town, and off the game that thrived in the rolling plains and wooded hills surrounding. The inhabitants mostly grew up skilled trackers and dead shots, owing to the scarcity of ammo for modern cartridge blasters and the slow reload rate of the black powder long blasters they also used, both of which made it important to make every shot count. Their marksmanship probably accounted for the fact that neither Coldhearts nor Muties, animal or vaguely human, had taken much advantage of Baron Mike's laxity. Until recently. In the past few months, a band of about 40 Muties, with, rumor had it, a few Norm renegades thrown in, had moved into the vicinity from the east in hopes of easier pickings. They had successfully surprised the large Tate family on its homestead in the woods a few miles northwest of town, overpowered them, and then killed, raped, and, rumor again said, eaten them, in no particular order. The initial success, however, had proved hard to repeat once the countryside was aware of them. The locals seemed none too inclined to avenge the Tates, who had been powerful enough almost to constitute a barony themselves, and displayed some nasty tendencies toward their neighbors. And anyway, the Tatestead was well defensible for a sizable band. However, they were inclined to come to one another's aid. They also liked to skulk and snipe. Just like that, the Mutie leader, a hugely fat, mustachioed scabby called El Cabron, found himself down to 25 assorted goons. So he decided to avail himself of the rule of law. Now, the Baron of Tucumcari had a daughter, Maria Elena, a legendary beauty, waist-length raven tresses, ivory skin, and notable rack. She was largely thought to be a virgin, which lent her a certain novelty value. So one night, not long ago, a picked band of Muties had slipped into the ville and made off with the Baron's daughter, leaving the head of her chaperone, an elderly lady cousin of impeccable respectability, on the globe surmounting the end post of the banister in the foyer of the Baron's splendid two-story frame mansion. The raiders had also left a written message, which, after it was painstakingly interpreted, proved to contain an ultimatum. The Baron would either compel his people to submit and pay tribute to El Cabron and his band, or Maria would be guest of honor at an old-fashioned Deathlands Mutie hoedown. Enter Magog. The new ville happened to lie smack by a divide in the tracks, one line running southeast, the other northeast. The locals, like most people, had paid no heed to the old weed-grown rails until the mighty railwag had miraculously turned up along them, gleaming and throbbing, a couple years past. Tucumcari was well up in the watershed of the mountains just to the west, and its denizens were eager to trade fresh water and game to the general's posse for trifling quantities of ammo and meds. So amenable were the folk of the ville, from Baron Mike down, that the general hadn't bothered leaving any sort of garrison, a constant drain on his limited manpower. But the general was about empire building, or rebuilding, and he understood the enormity of the task, as maybe no one else then alive did. That was why he was so hipped on getting hands on the great redoubt, no matter how obdurately his intel chief failed to understand. so he jumped at the chance to bind the Vilt to him more closely through goodwill. It was also a chance to try to get some use out of another of the odd but highly capable band of captives, now quasi-recruits, Hubertus was always wanting to torture. The albino youth Jack Lauren had been kept in a cell since the cold heart attack. It wasn't his punishment. The general had ordered him to be well-treated, but considered him a feral rogue. Doc spoke glowingly of his combat prowess, though, so the general directed that the youth and a trio of Magog Sekhmen be dispatched to rescue the Baron's daughter.
Yeah, too bad. Here she got a rock.
Besides, he's a muti. Who gives a diseased rat's dick about a low-life nuke-suck muti?
He ain't a muti. Says he ain't.
Shut up, stoop. Unless you want me to reckon you for a taint, too. That what you are? A dirty muti lover?
Both of you shut the fuck up.
Karnes had a hard, thin, stubbly face and mad eyes. The camo stick face paint he, like the other two, wore in jags of brown and green and black made his eyes seem to stand right out of his head. He was junior to Brassard, just a scrubby private, but he came from a long line of woods runners from the mountains up Taos way and put up with no man's shit. They were all hunkered down behind an outbuilding near the woods in back of the former Tate main house. Mickles, Karnes, and the corporal carried M16s. It was broad daylight. Despite that fact, there was no sign of muties moving about the place. Just a few skinny horses browsing, hopefully, in the bare dirt of a corral. Along with Baron Mike's daughter, the raiders had made off with a startling percentage of his stock of scavied pre-dark liquor, which might have accounted for the lack of apparent activity.
Corporal?
Shut up, Nichols.
But that girl, you think?
What Brassard thought would remain a mystery, because just then a shirtless, scratching muti came around the rear of the shed in search of a place to take a leak and all but stepped on Karnes. Jack wasn't a lot of things, and Squeamish was right up there. All the same, he was having trouble breathing in the ground floor of what had been the Tate House. The miasma was made up of mildew, rancid human grease, dreck, piss so well fermented it seemed like the muties weren't to blame for it all, rotting food, burned bedding, farts, spilled ale, decomposing flesh, and various vintages of puke. Squeamish Jack wasn't, but he did have a sensitive nose, and the nastiest stagnant Blackwater Bayou with an old swollen-up dead gator festering in it back home couldn't hold a candle to this majestic reek. Also, somebody, the muties or the former occupants, had tacked up bedspreads and tablecloths and random scraps over the windows, casting the interior of the big old two-story structure into dismal gloom. Slipping the hook-and-eye lock on the back door with the leaf blade of one of his throwing knives, Jack had come in through the kitchen, down a short corridor to the front room and the foot of the stairs. He had come upon three marauders, two sleeping muties, and an apparently normal human passed out, with his bearded face sideways in a pool of vomit. Three quick, sure strokes of a throwing knife had ensured that no ensuing ruction, no matter how frenetic, would disturb their rest. Nor would anything else. At the base of the stairs, he paused. He heard voices from above, muffled as by a door. No hope existed of detecting any sentries or anybody abroad in the upstairs hall by body odor. However foul it might be, it just had too much competition. He put his hand to a wall and listened and felt, trying to sense footprints, breathing, even shifting of weight. Nothing he could perceive. He stole carefully up the stained hardwood stairs, as mindful not to slip in any pools of anything as to avoid making noise. Though his knives were tucked away in sundry convenient location, his hands were empty. His .357 Magnum Colt Python, returned to him by his captors for this mission, rode inside a shoulder holster in his left armpit. On the opposite side were pouches for three speed loaders. A collapsible aluminum spear, provided for the raid, was stuck through his belt. Sergeant Banner had been almost solicitous in making sure he had everything he wanted or thought he needed for this snoop and poop. He had also been almost eager when making it clear that if the albino youth ran out on them, his friends would suffer. Halting at the top of the stairs, Jack stuck his head tentatively up above floor level. The window at the hall's end was swaddled in a big, pale paisley comforter, stained with water or whatever, which allowed dim tobacco spit-colored light. Nobody was in the hall, and the only door closed was on his left. The voices came from behind it. Seemingly insubstantial as fog, he flowed up onto the second floor and up beside the closed door.